STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Here we are in hour two, Hit Stand to Reason. I'm Jay Warner Wallace, and I'm sitting in this week for about everybody who in Stand to Reason is out on the mission field one way or another. Greg Kokel is usually here with you, and he is going to be away for one more week. So I'm here with you the first hour, and this is now hour two. And we get a chance to talk to a friend of mine who I'm watching this guy's career as a Christian casemaker. And just his story. I mean, every one of us has got a different story about how it is we came to faith and what that, you know, looks like and what the experience was, what kind of idiosyncrasies about our own life now kind of feed into how we work as Christian casemakers. And Abdu Murray is in a no different position. I'm going to get him on the line here real quick, but then I want to introduce you. So, Abdu, are you there, brother?
I'm here.
Just be patient with me because I want to, yeah. I mean, lots of folks know who you are, but for the just odd chance there's somebody out there who's not familiar with your work, just sit quietly while I talk your praises, okay?
You got it.
You know, I know that, that if you've not followed Abdu's work, you've probably seen him about everywhere because he's got so many different feet in different projects. He is the founder and is the president of Embrace the Truth International. And, you know, he was a Muslim and who studied the Quran for most of his life. And it took a 9-year investigation. We were talking last hour about how cool it would be if people would just know this is true because they actually investigated it. Well, Abdu did that. And he kind of compared all the historical, philosophical, the scientific underpinnings of all the major world religions and then discovered that the historic kind of view of Christian faith really alone uniquely answered the questions. And this is, I think, Abdu, honestly, your book is so powerful in that regard. But you've spoken, Abdu, at a number of different venues, and I know now you're really active with RZIM. You're both there on your website. You're on their website as well. And what I love about your work is that you, you basically have kind of come up through the same kind of legal background. You're an attorney. You've been voted several times one of the best lawyers in America, which I think is pretty cool. And now to take that stature, that platform you have in that field, and turn it into a platform for the Christian casemaking. So very, very cool. So this is my guest today, Abdu Murray, from both RZIM and Embrace the Truth International. So Abdu, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad to have you today.
Well, Jim, it's so great to be with you, and thanks for that glowing introduction. That was I can't live up to that.
Well, I can tell you that we've had a chance to kind of hang out in our families and have pizza together, and it's just been great to kind of listen to your story and also to kind of see how God is using you incrementally year after year of watching your influence grow, watching your platform grow, watching what this book has done in terms of reaching a community that really needs to hear and be able to compare what Christianity teaches, and that's why I'm just glad to have you on the show today.
Well, it's a matter.
So, Abdu, let me just ask you this. I kind of laid a foundation here, but I haven't talked to you probably in 3 months. So just catch me up. Tell me what is going on and introduce yourself to the people here a little bit more and tell them a little bit about who you are and how it is you got to where you are today.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I was raised as a devoted Shiite Muslim. You know, there's the Sunnis and there's the Shiites, and the Sunnis are the majority of the Muslims, and the Shiites are the minority. Not like a 5% kind of minority. It's a pretty sizable minority, actually. And of course, Iran is a largely Shiite nation, and Iraq, and these kind of things. Well, I was from Lebanese background, and I was raised here in the States. And you know, I had this wacky sort of nutty idea that people should believe true things and not false things. And I thought that Islam was true, and that everything else was categorically false by definition. If it rejected Islam, it was therefore false. And so I made it my mission to, not in a sort of obnoxious stand on the corner and thump my Quran at you kind of a way, but in a conversation with friends. Eventually we turned the conversation over to matters of God and theology and existence and these kind of things. And I would try to poke holes in the Christian faith and offer Islam. When I created the vacuum, when someone couldn't defend their faith, I would create the vacuum, and then I would offer Islam as the substitute in order to fill that vacuum. And it was going pretty well, actually. Doing that for a long time until I found some rather annoying people, these Christians who actually knew what they were talking about, knew what they believed and why they believed it, and gave me some challenges back. And that sort of started the 9-year journey into becoming a Christian. I'm sort of giving the truncated version, obviously, but once I became a Christian, and the nine-year search, Jim, wasn't really because the answers were hard to find. They actually were not easy to find, but they weren't all that hard to find. I found them within a couple of years, really, to all my deepest questions. It was that they were hard to accept, because you're talking about a complete worldview shift, you're talking about an identity shift, you're talking about a cultural shift. And so that took some time to digest. And once I became a believer, I'm sort of a natural-born advocate. That's what I do. And I wanted people to believe the truth. And I thought Christianity was true. So we launched into this ministry thing. We were doing it on the side for a long time. But as the Lord had led and opportunities were growing, and people wanted to hear not just about Islam, but also other things that were challenging the Christian faith, I found myself having more opportunities to not only equip Christians, but do my favorite thing in the world, which is evangelism. And we started the ministry about 10 years ago, and it went full-time about 3 years ago.
Wow. And I can tell you that I've watched it grow year after year, but you said something really, really powerful when you said that you met Christians, that you were actually able to fill a void that was caused when you realized they could not defend their own faith. They left this void of knowledge, basically, that you would come in and try to fill with your knowledge of the Quran, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because it doesn't take that much to really get people thinking about their own worldview. I had a question, some kind of a variation of this kind of a question, somewhere early on in the conversation. And again, it was almost always a friendly conversation. And it began something like this: why are you a Christian?
Right.
And 9 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10, the answer was, well, I was raised that way.
We just talked about this the last hour.
Or I go to the Presbyterian church on Easter and Christmas and
that's
that kind of
awesome.
Thing. And that was the foundation.
Yeah, we just talked about it. And so now that being all they had, you found you were in a position where you could actually offer something a little more thoughtful, didn't you?
Yeah, well, what I would do is I would take some things that I, you know, had sort of learned over the course of the time. You know, a lot of Muslims actually learn apologetics or a defense of their own faith, but also polemics, sitting at the kitchen table with their family members, especially their male family members. And I would learn the arguments, and then I started taking them more seriously and reading the Bart Ehrman books and all these kind of things. So I would engage with Christians, and then when they'd tell me that their worldview was based largely on tradition, I would say, well, wait a minute. If it's based on tradition, then how do you know it's true? I mean, this Bible you're talking about has been changed over time. Don't you know even your own scholars, like Bart Ehrman, and I had an assumption, by the way, Jim, if you were white and not Jewish, that meant you were a Christian. And so, because Bart Ehrman is white and not Jewish, I thought he was a Christian, and I said, even your own scholars are telling you that, you know, your Bible's been changed. And the eyes got wide, the mouth got closed, and they had nothing to respond with. Because they didn't know how to defend the authenticity of their scriptures. Or I would take apart the Trinity. I'd say, the Trinity makes no sense. Don't you know there's only one God and he doesn't need helpers? You guys have Father, Son, Holy Spirit. It sounds like a whole bunch of people who need help to me. And how could that be a God who is great? The incarnation makes no sense. The atonement. I would do all this. I would sort of run them through the mill on this. And then when they were totally spent, it's like, well, here's the substitute that responds to every objection I just gave, but gives you, you know, Islam as the answer. But once in a while, there were some people who actually did know what they were talking about and could actually give me a good run for my money.
Well, isn't that just an example of why this is so important? People think that this is just this little niche thing that some of us are interested in. 10% of the church is interested in this kind of niche little, you know, we're all like Star Trek fans, you know, at these Star Trek conventions. You know, we're just a subset of the larger church that have this weird inclination. When in fact, what we're screaming here is that, look, this has been our own experience, is that if this is the only answer we can give as a Christian, that we were raised in the church, I kind of call this accidental Christian. You happen to be in the right place, but you're there by accident. And that's really what I think your story is so great. You stayed in that position where you were able to kind of needle those Christians who had no answers, you said, until you met some knowledgeable Christians. Do you mind kind of sharing what that experience was like? Who did you meet?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And let me just say this to your point about this is not just a bunch of people getting together for conventions and sort of sharing nerd stories. It's so much more important than that, Jim, because as I go and I'm talking to people, and this is back in my Muslim days, and I'm engaging with them, I did not know Christ. And, of course, him being the only answer, his way being the only way to heaven, I was in danger of not going to heaven, of not having my salvation. And the Christians, this is not to indict Christians in general. I mean, I don't want to do that, but here's the point. That every Christian who had no idea why they believed what they believed, who couldn't respond to my challenge, was not only failing to respond to my challenge, and they were actually thinking Islam might be true, but they were actually affirming my skepticism. When I said there is no answer in Christianity, and then they provided me with none, they were affirming it for me. They were sort of doing an unevangelism.
Yeah.
Their lack of answer was getting me deeper and deeper into Islam, and I was more and more convicted that Christianity is bunk and Islam is the answer. But then there were two guys who came to my door. They were going door to door at the University of Michigan, where I did my undergraduate degree. Two Baptist guys, Dave and Pete. I remember them vividly because Dave was this sort of short guy and, like, you know, tons of hair coming out of everywhere, and Pete was this super skinny tall guy who was the stone bald, like a walking number 10, these two guys. And they came to our door, and, you know, they were going door to door, trying to talk about Jesus to people in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's kind of like Berkeley, California, where it's, you know, a little on the liberal side.
Yes.
So they weren't getting tons of reaction, or they, if they were getting reaction, it was a lot of negative reaction, like, go away, fundamentalists, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
But they came to our door, and they knocked on my door. I opened the door, and there they were, and they said, you know, we're from the Baptist church down the street. And I said to myself, oh, my goodness, they actually deliver. This is great.
This is awesome, yeah.
I don't have to look for them. They deliver to my house.
This is great.
So they came in, and we had some lengthy conversations. And here's the real thing here, the real heart of the matter. I made Dave and Pete very uncomfortable for hours at a time. But those two guys came back to my apartment Thursday after Thursday for something like 12, 13 Thursdays in a row. We actually spanned a semester. And they gave me some were good answers, some weren't as good as they could have been, but sometimes they gave me the best answer you can give a guy. I don't know. I'll get back to you. And then they did. Ironically, that's when I was first introduced to Reasons to Believe in the work of Hugh Ross and those folks, because they brought me a tape on, it was a VHS actually back then, on creation and the Bible and all these things, and sort of looking into it more seriously. And so that was sort of the impetus, like, you know what, this is starting to, you know, maybe there's more to it than I did than I thought originally. And I started hearing Ravi. I heard Ravi on the radio, sort of by providence, really. And I heard an Indian guy talking about Jesus. I thought that was fascinating. I got to listen more to that.
Right.
And then I heard Stand to Reason on the radio. So there was more and more apologetics surrounding me. And I started to think to myself, this is actually not the pushover I thought it was. This is not the straw man. This is actually worth engaging in a very serious way. So, you know, thank God for people like that who can engage and stand up to tough scrutiny and say, you know what, Christianity can take it, and you're worth it to engage with.
Isn't that interesting that you said that a lack of the ability to answer the objections really was the lack of ability to evangelize you? And not only that, it strengthens your disbelief. And that's an aspect of what we do as case makers that I think most people overlook. We kind of think, oh, this is kind of optional. But really, almost all of us feel a desire to evangelize. We all feel this great commission calling on our lives, yet we seem to detach it so far from having answers of this nature. But at least these two guys, and so it sounds like this is another thing I think was encouraging. It sounds, Abdul, like these two guys were not like apologetics kind of aficionados or, you know, really well-trained or, well, they knew enough to get started, it sounds like, but they weren't like great apologists. Am I right or wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. They didn't come expecting to get into these deep philosophical discussions and historical stuff. They knew enough to be able to answer some basic questions. But like I said, they gave the greatest answer you can give a guy sometimes is, I don't know, and I'll get back to you. And then they went ahead and did, and they learned. And in fact, I discovered during the course of that time we were interacting, they were growing stronger in their own faith because they were actually being forced to look at their own scriptures and the validity. And I was asking them questions, and they were getting forced to look at them. And they came out of it, I think, even stronger Christians. So it sort of really backfired on me because I wanted them to become Muslims. But they ended up becoming stronger Christians because of it.
Oh, so another great example.
It did help. Yeah, so you don't have to be, and this is a great point you're raising, is that you don't have to be a Jim Wallis or a Greg Kokel or a Ravi Zacharias to engage in these kind of discussions. You can just be you, know something, and engage in the conversations and make them prolonged. That's what these guys did.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, at the time, were you married, Abdul, when this happened?
I was not. I was not married yet. I wouldn't even meet my wife for another probably 10 years.
Wow. Okay. So tell me how you're, and we're going to move to your book here in just a second, but I want, before we go to this next section of our show,
sure.
just catch me up in terms of what, how you felt that your background as a lawyer weighed in to your both examination of Christianity and how did it change? How did your Christian worldview then affect your work as a lawyer?
Well, my love for evidence and for understanding argument and laying it out, that was sort of ingrained in me. Call it the Mediterranean in me, I don't know what it is, but I had this desire to argue and make a point and be an advocate for something. But I also wanted to make sure I was on the right side of stuff. So as I began to learn how evidence is actually collected, how evidence is actually admitted into court, I mean, not just, and sometimes evidence is actually evidence, but it's not admissible.
Right.
And both you and I have been on the good side and the bad of rulings on evidentiary issues in trials, where it's like, oh, come on, this is so relevant, and
it gets
excluded, or sometimes it gets included, and you're like, this is great.
Yeah.
Because evidence has relevance if it makes any fact at issue more or less likely to be true. And I wanted to see what evidence could make, you know, Christianity, Islam, or whatever, more or less likely to be true. And my love for evidence actually drove that sort of investigation further and further, because I understood how it was collected and how it should be presented and what weight it should be given, because not all evidence has equal weight. Well, when I discovered that Christianity actually, on so many levels, historically speaking, philosophically speaking, all these things began to answer my toughest questions, and the ones that I didn't just, you know, curiosity, you know, sort of led me to those questions, but the questions that I longed to have answered, when it began to answer just all those questions, I began to see a cohesive worldview. I began to see even my own place as an attorney wasn't just, yeah, I go to work, I advocate for a client or two, I do something, I go to court and make an argument, I sit down, I go home, and then that's my day. You begin to see, I think, the world as, wow, this all fits together, right and wrong, moral values, what is objectively morally true, how do you take a position and understand where it all fits in the great scheme of things. I certainly got, and I don't want to sort of wax too eloquent on this, but I certainly got, in terms of my own career as a lawyer, a foundational idea about what ethics really means and what it means to be a part of a bigger picture as a lawyer. It wasn't just a job. It became a career. It became something that mattered to people, whether it was my clients or the other side or the system, system in general. And I think Christianity helped to undergird all that for me.
Yeah, very, very powerful. And here it was now years later when you were the person who was first impacted by a couple of faithful Christians who may not have had the answers, but were willing to weigh in and walk you through some of those answers. Now, here you are years later doing the same thing for others, strengthening Christians in what they believe and reaching the lost by comparing worldviews. You have a book now called Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews. And that is, I think, a great entry into your now a position you're taking, using all the skills that God gave you in both your professional life and in the search you went through to discover if Christianity is true, I think are reflected perfectly in this book. We're going to take a quick break. And after we come back, I want you to just kind of answer and talk a little bit about the nature of this book. You know, a lot of times when we talk about apologetics books, I mean, my gosh, we all collect these books. And the question is, you know, why should anybody want to embrace a book like yours? I think this is one of those books you want to have on your shelf. But I want you to be able to share that with the listeners as well. We'll do that right after the break here on Stand to Reason.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at str.org.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel, talking to Abdu Murray. And I'll get him back on the line here. Abdu, thanks for joining us again here today. We talked a little bit about how cool your story is, and I think that's important for people to hear because, you know, I think we kind of delegate this role of case making to just a select few in the church, the same way that sometimes as Christians we delegate certain forms of leadership to our pastor, certain forms of authority or responsibility for learning to our pastors. We don't embrace those for ourselves. And it turns out that most of the people who I've met who have become well known as Christian case makers are folks who began, I mean, Greg, all these folks, we all began just having a passion for this without the training. We got the training as we kind of went along, and we made a decision to do this, and you did the same thing. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It's once I sort of embraced the Christian worldview and I realized, you know, gosh, if this is what gets me to heaven, if this is the salvation that I have, why would I not want this for everybody else? And, you know, I think apologetics, maybe this is my sort of bias playing into it, but my view is apologetics serves evangelism, not the other way around. We use apologetics as a tool for our evangelism, but we also get it as a matter of strengthening our own faith in a way that's so profound. And you can start off reading sort of the entry-level books, you know, Josh McDowell's More Than a Carpenter and these right. kind of things, move mm-hmm. on to more advanced stuff like Cold Case Christianity and all these things. And, you know, then we started to get these bases. That's how I started. And then you get to, you know, more scholarly stuff as you do more research and that kind of thing. And before right. you know it, you know, you're ready to do it. Well, but you don't even have to be all that learned, and that, you know, it's all out there now with the fact that this information is available at their fingertips. They go to like your blog, for example, or str.org, and they got a question someone raises during a discussion that they can't answer. Man, it's right there. It's right there.
Yeah. Almost no excuse anymore.
It's something that anybody can do, whether yeah. they're lay people or they're seminary people. It's not a job that's relegated to a certain select few. I don't think any one of us, me, you, Greg, Ravi, anybody would say that we're exceptional people. I would say that we're just ordinary people who follow an exceptional Savior and want to introduce people to Him, and apologetics is how we do it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think what's interesting is, and I forget who was in your book, who originally, I think it was Mike Lycona, when he kind of endorsed the book, he said a couple things about your book. And I think you've given far more ado than is required for Cold Case. I mean, I feel like you maybe, I don't feel like an expert in any of these things. I just feel like a member of the jury who's passionate enough to maybe want to be the foreman of this jury, because we're all in a position we have to make a decision together, and we're going to listen to the testimony of expert witnesses, and at some point we're going to be in that jury room talking back and forth to each other, persuading each other that who's right, who's wrong, how should we vote. That kind of dialogue occurs in the jury room, and I think we just need to be really well-informed, passionate, interested jurors. We don't have to be the expert witnesses. But what I love about what Mike said about your book, Mike Lycona said, I like this book for two major reasons. In these pages, Abdu examines the major worldviews fairly and provides a fresh approach to showing how the Christian gospel best answers worldview questions pertaining to value, purpose, suffering, and the greatness of God. That's what you just said a minute ago in your own search. And then he says, moreover, Abdu is a former practicing Muslim and attorney who has successfully field tested in public forums the ideas you present. I wanted, before we start talking about your book, Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews, I wanted to talk about the second sentence here that Mike talks about, which is that all of us as speakers, we typically speak for years on the topics we end up writing about. And that is the place where we kind of work out the details. I'll bet, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this book is field tested before you ever started putting pen to paper. Am I right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, the entire Islam section, for example, is not only field tested in terms of open forums and dialogues with Muslims, either at mosques or universities, but of course in my own life. In fact, that section of the book specifically recounts the major issues, the problems I had with Christianity, and how I resolved those problems, and how they ended up becoming the things that I love the most about the Christian faith.
Right.
In my open forums and debates with atheists, I see some of the common thread, the common question, the common core that happens there, and that sort of formed the basis of the section on secular humanism.
Right.
And then in my interactions with those from the New Age and all these things and Hinduism, that formed their common objections and their writings and looking what they love and what they care about, that formed the section on pantheism and the sort of, you know, New Age movement. So this is all born out of specifically going out there and doing it, and specifically also talks I've given on worldview,
right,
where we did it at open forums, and we, you know, invited skeptics and Hindus and Muslims and atheists up to the mic and began to interact on these things, both in public settings and, of course, in private settings.
Okay, so let me go back then, and let's just talk about this to the audience. I want you to explain to me, why did you write Grand Central Question? Just give me that answer first. Why did you write it?
Well, and this sort of goes back to the idea that we all feel like someone has to be relegated to be the expert to have this kind of discussions with our non-Christian friends. I really had two audiences in mind. The first one was Christians, who I think sometimes feel paralyzed that they don't know enough about atheism or, you know, the scientific issues to engage in conversation, or they don't know enough about Islam to talk to their Muslim neighbor and engage in a serious discussion. They're sort of afraid of it. So what I wanted to show them was, in Grand Central Question, is, yeah, it's great to know a lot of answers and be able to take all the issues head on, but sometimes there's a central question, and oftentimes every worldview has a central question, that if that question is answered, and if you can know something about that question, real, meaningful conversations spring from just knowing how to answer the one question, and that's a great way to get started. The second audience was non-Christians. Everything I write, every time I speak, no matter what setting it's in, I'm always thinking about those who aren't Christians. Are they listening in? Are they reading this stuff? And I want to speak to them and say, this is why I think this is credible, and offer it to them as well. I wanted to be fair to their worldviews. So when I discuss secularism, I want to be fair to secularists and Muslims and all these things. So I want to take what is a central question, simplify it down to the central question, but be fair in doing so.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, and I think that's one of the beauties of the book. So let's just talk about then the kind of the structure of the book and why I think this is unusual. This idea, I love the idea, first of all, of getting down to the nuts and bolts of what is the one permeating, kind of the one, like you said, the central question in each worldview. Now, you chose, though, a number of worldviews to examine and compare to both one another and to Christianity. Let's talk about that. Why did you choose, and how did you structure the book so it's accessible to people in that regard?
Well, I was taking a look at the ones from my own experience and being out there in public forums and these kind of things and saying, what are the ones that are competing for the hearts and minds of people more than any others? I mean, there's a huge menu of religions and non-religions to pick.
Right.
But I wanted to say, I wanted to look at and see what are the main ones that are competing for the hearts and minds of people, and then say, okay, look at those, the umbrella ones, secular humanism, which is sort of the worldview face of atheism, and it's sort of like the, you know, this is the friendly version, come and join us, we're secular humanists, we're for something. You know, atheism gets this sort of reputation of being against something, like I'm against belief in God, whereas secular humanism sounds popular and positive. It's we're pro-human.
Right,
kind of
right, sure. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to address the central issue there. Pantheism, you know, we think oftentimes of Hindus and Eastern religions as way over there and other countries and other continents we'll never interact with. But the fact of the matter is, in popular culture and in new religions like Scientology, the New Age, the sort of spirituality of Oprah Winfrey and Deepak Chopra, it's here and it's pretty prevalent. We have to deal with the pantheistic worldview. And then Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. No one is a stranger to Islam anymore. We're unfortunately very aware of the unpleasant aspects of it. But the fact of the matter is, too, that we have so many Muslim neighbors and friends in this country and in Canada and all over the world who are not radicals, who are not looking to blow up airports. They just want to have a conversation with you about ultimate truths. So I picked those three worldviews because I think those are the ones that are the most influential and the ones that compete with Christianity in the most serious way.
Now, and Josh McDowell writes your foreword, and he says something in the foreword that I thought was interesting because it's true about the nature of the structure of your book. He says, hey, you can. He wants everyone to read the book cover to cover, but you got to start with the prologue. Basically, you're framing what's at stake here, and you're framing about the nature of truth. But what's great about your book at that point is you could, I think, move if you wanted to jump and read part three first before you read part one, because you've got a family that you really want to understand more deeply the issues related to Islam, or maybe you've got a family that's really atheist, so you really want to stay in that part one's going to have special value to you. As long as you read the prologue first, you are able to navigate this book, and any one of these sections is kind of a standalone. Would you agree?
Yeah, in fact, I debated long and hard about whether to make three separate books, actually. But then the idea of how it all coalesces, how all the central questions of every other worldview can be answered in a coherent and cohesive way by Christianity, actually, I thought was a better way to do it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I actually thought about that in writing it and thinking, if we go to the prologue section first, which is really sort of a how-to of evangelism. It's
right.
A understanding people's barriers aren't always intellectual. In fact, usually they're not. The intellectual is a smokescreen, and how do we deal with that? That's the prologue. And then every single worldview has its own section. Secular humanism is the first section. Pantheism is the second section. And Islam is the third section. You could go right to section three if you wanted and not even read any parts of the secular humanism or the pantheism parts. And I hope that by the time you're done reading it, you will come away understanding Islam, understanding the core concern of Islam and Muslims themselves, and how to offer them the gospel hope. And then jump back to part one if you want to. It's not a reference book in one sense, but it's also a reference book in the sense that you can go to any section you want to and not feel cheated.
Well, it's a training manual in a sense. I mean, it's not a reference book, and that reference book's kind of like sitting on that you go to it occasionally to find some information. This is really about how to animate yourself to be able to do something powerful. This is the kind of the training foundation that'll give you the power to actually act, to do something. But you said something very important, I think, when you said a minute ago, and we're going to jump into these three areas. I want to get with what is the grand central question in each of these three areas, but as briefly as we can, of course. But I wanted to ask you, you said that most of the time, and you're spot on, you're right, that it's not always a rational objection that really lies at the root of what the problem is with people. It's and I always talk about this too. It's not just there's three reasons why anyone denies a truth claim, and only one of them is rational. And it's not usually the case to begin with. But when you say that, I mean, I'm always afraid to say it I don't have a problem saying it to other Christians, but I think as the atheist that I was, if you'd have told me that you think as a Christian that my problem is not rational, it's something else, I would have been deeply offended because, of course, even though you're right, the thing I would have always said as an atheist, I'm not going to tell you it's an emotional objection or a volitional objection. I'm going to tell you it's a rational objection because the other two make me sound weak. So I would have always argued that, I've got rational. You've got no evidence to support your view. I have evidence to support my view. I was going to stand in that regard. But really, my presuppositions that lied at the base of my looking at the evidence were the problem. And a lot of that, you're right. It wasn't merely rational, but do you ever find yourself, Abdu, saying, wow, if I say that, have I already alienated the group I'm trying to reach?
Yeah, and that's the real danger, is that if you say it out loud, it sounds in one sense condescending, like, you're not willing to listen, you just have all this emotional baggage, which is, of course, ironic, because oftentimes I think skeptics would say that Christians hold on to Christianity because of emotional baggage. So they can say it, we're not offended, but they say it, and they get offended. But I do think you run a risk. However, I think there's a way to actually do this, a way to actually bring this cost out in artful ways. And I think the listeners of Stand to Reason are no stranger to the fact that asking questions brings out assumptions and it brings out people's underlying baggage.
That's right.
I remember when I was asking Christians why they were Christians, they'd tell me tradition. And a lot of them were reticent to sort of let go of tradition and see if it's true or not because they were afraid of consequences, which is interesting because you think in a free society you wouldn't be afraid of the consequences, but changing a worldview can be pretty scary.
Yeah.
So what no Christian ever asked me was, why was I a Muslim? They never asked me that question. They just simply, I was, probably because I was playing on the defensive the whole time, but they never really asked me that question.
Fascinating.
And I wish they had, because at some point, over the course of that 9-year search, finally, I was asked that question, and the real answer was because I had to be. I'd found evidence and some rationale for why I was a Muslim to justify my beliefs, but the real fundamental reason was because it was my identity, it was who I was, and I wasn't going to give that up. I think if we ask our friends in the middle of a conversation about the consequences that might come from that, or to find out if there's some underlying reason for their question, take the problem of evil, for example. I don't think that's ever asked in a purely academic way. Sure, we have academic answers and we have academic objections, but almost no one ever asks the problem of evil in a vacuum. They've experienced suffering, or someone they know has experienced suffering. And sometimes letting go of our anger can be a problem. And if we just understand the person, we're not doing it just to sort of condescend. We're trying to understand what is the issue, what is the thing that speaks to this person's heart and their mind. We can do it, and that's what I was endeavoring to do in that prologue section,
yes,
is to give a how-to go through this without being condescending.
Yeah, awesome. That's it. That prologue, that's why I wanted to start with that. That really is kind of the worth the price of the book right there, because it does kind of set the stage. And then now what I'm going to do after the break, we're going to take the break here in just a second, and what I'm going to do, we're going to take a little bit early, because I'm going to come back. I want you to go through, and I'm going to test your skills as an orator, okay? Because I'm going to ask you to give me the grand central question for each of these three worldviews and kind of tease out just a little bit as to why how we might answer or address this, or what's deficient or excellent about the position each of these takes. And I want you to do each one in about 5 minutes. So that gives you 15 minutes to do three worldviews. I think it'd be really helpful for our listeners. And we'll do that, everyone, right after this break here at Stand to Reason.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of ambassador's guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, postmodernism, the New Atheists, pluralism, understanding homosexuality, and the voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas. And we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Okay, we're here in hour two. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason, talking to Abdu Murray. And you just heard our Brett Kunkel talking about the Rethink conferences. If you have not sent your young person, your student, your son, your daughter to a Rethink, we've got them now in two strategic locations on the West Coast and in Central and Dallas there, where you can actually join us for Rethink. And you really, I just want a gratuitous plug for what Brett has done with those conferences. They are one of a kind. There is no one doing better and larger student apologetics conferences than Stand to Reason. So if you just want to invite you to join us at one of those two conferences. Also, we are almost always involved at Summit Worldview Conference. Greg, Brett, Alan, Abdu, and myself are there teaching. So I want to encourage you also to get involved in Summit. And finally, don't forget our cruise coming up to Alaska August 6th through the 13th. Join us as we get John Stone Street, myself, Greg Kokel. And you can get more information about that at 1-800-247-1899. All right, now that being said, I know, Abdu, that you really are as engaged and as concerned about young people as all of us here at Stand to Reason are. And you're committed. I've seen you. I'm always just barely miss you. I think it was last week, we missed each other again at Summit. I'm always hoping I'll bump into you when I get there, but we're always about a day or two away from each other there. So here, I want you to kind of have that group in mind, because I think when we talk to young people in that 15 to 30 age range, we're also talking to their parents who want to help them as they move through that age range. And so we catch an even larger, we're throwing an even larger net. So with that group in mind, because I think that that actually is a group that kind of encompasses everybody through their parents. Tell us what, let's go through one at a time. We'll start with secular humanism. And the section of the book is simply called this, Secular Humanism or the Gospel, which provides us with intrinsic value and objective purpose. So I assume that's what you would say is the central question, but I'll let you go ahead and just talk about that for the first up as far as worldviews, secular humanism.
Oh, absolutely. That is really, secular humanism is so well positioned to give you what its grand central question is, because the name says it all. Humanism originally is the idea that human beings, in and of themselves, have intrinsic value and objective purpose, that there's something about us that is valuable in and of ourselves. We don't sort of derive it from someone else. In other words, the government or the state doesn't give us value. We have it ourselves. So there's the affirmation that we all have purpose and value, but secular, we don't need God for that. Secular, of course, from the Latin meaning this world, we don't need God to tell us that we have objective value. And you can see this through all of the humanist manifestos. I don't know what it is about humanists, but they love manifestos. There's so many of them. But they declare over and over again how, you know, humans are valuable and we have a shared dignity and we can sort of reach rough agreement on moral values and these kind of things. I think the central flaw here, however, is that when you begin to read their own writings and you look at the only evidence there really is for what our purpose actually is, it undercuts their view. So they're saying that we have objective purpose and value. But then you see something like from Richard Dawkins, for example, when he's asked, what is the purpose of humanity? He says, and I'm almost quoting verbatim now, we are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for living. Well, if that's the purpose, then how do we have intrinsic value and dignity? We're just DNA machines. And I don't think any of us looked in the mirror today as we were getting ready for work or whatever it was and thought, man, I am one snappy-dressed DNA machine.
Yeah, right.
You know, no one does that. We don't look in the sweet face of a baby and say, this is a really cute DNA propagator. So it wants to affirm human value. That's what the whole humanist endeavor is. But by jettisoning God, by jettisoning an objective source for human value, it's undercut itself. It's as if he sawed off the limb on which it sits.
Yeah, great way of putting it. Now, I always think the same thing, too. If you're saying that our whole goal, our whole purpose is to we are DNA machines, what really distinguishes us as a species from other species of DNA machines? I mean, okay, so that's the goal of and the purpose of all of us as humans. Isn't that also the goal and purpose of my pet corgi, you know, and that breed of dogs? I mean, what is it then that separates us from other? And is this why in secular humanism you sometimes see the elevation of other species to equal status as humans? Because how would we differentiate between these two species anyway?
It's interesting you say that because, you know, there's this book called Aping Mankind by Raymond Tallis, who is, by the way, an atheist and a neuroscientist. And he calls this whole phenomenon Darwinitis and neuromania, where we seek to reduce human beings. We sort of animalize human beings so we reduce ourselves while raising animals up. Because we're recognizing if there is no God, then there is no distinction. We're just DNA machines. We happen to be smarter. Our meat computer happens to be better than their meat computer, and that's it.
Yeah, wow.
And that simply can't be the case. If that were the case, then why would there be outrage from the atheist about racism? Why would there be outrage? I mean moral outrage, not like a Darwinian sort of inconvenience, but why is there an actual moral outrage over these things? Unless there's an ontic referent, unless there's something that points us to objective human purpose. And if something's objective, if and only if, it does not depend on human opinion.
Right.
If it depends on human opinion, it's subjective.
That's
by
right.
Definition.
Right.
Well, human beings, if there's no God, we're it. We're the last word. So human value does depend on human opinion. And therefore, it's subjective. You know, Stephen Jay Gould actually says, and I point this out in the book, Stephen Jay Gould specifically says, there is no higher answer. He calls that reality superficially troubling, if not terrifying. And I think it's terrifying because if that's the case, then where does it end? Because we do see arguments by leading philosophers who will tell us that certain people should be allowed to live,
that's right,
and certain people don't have to live. We can kill them if we want to because they're inconvenient. And I'm not making that up. That's actually being spoken at our leading universities. Because if we have no intrinsic value, then we are the ones who get to determine it. And that is a scary thing, because if history's shown us one thing, we're very bad at securing human value.
I want to move from this idea of a secular humanism as a worldview, and because we're going to try to go through all three. Then we'll kind of come back, if I have time, to ask you a few questions in the middle here. But I want to make sure we get all three on the table. Let's go to part two, which is Eastern and Western spirituality. What is the grand central question for kind of a pantheistic or a kind of an Eastern spirituality? What is the grand central question there?
Sure. When you look at the way Eastern spirituality and its Western sort of iterations from the New Age and the new spirituality of Chopra et al., what you have really is the search for the escape from suffering. The foundational issue of pantheism is that we are divine beings, we just forgot about it. And we're in a world of suffering because we are under the illusion that we're not divine. And so through the payment of karma and the use of meditation and chants and all these things, we will eventually realize our own divinity and escape a world of suffering. So the real central question for the pantheist is, how do I escape suffering? How do I deal with suffering, and how do I escape it? Because it claims it's an illusion.
Right.
And so that's the central question. How do we deal with and escape suffering?
Yeah. So tell me why then, how do you argue, or not argue, but how do you discuss or begin a conversation with people who will argue that it's an illusion? How do you kind of show the inherent flaws in this thinking?
Well, there's a couple of things that are just logical flaws right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
If you're inherently a divine or a powerful being, but you're under the illusion that you're not, in other words, you're God, that's what pantheism means, that everything is God, including you. The question starts with this. How did you get fooled? If you're the divine being, who has the power and the influence to fool you into thinking you're not? It seems to me to have a logical flaw right off the bat.
Sure.
But I think there's a more human level to this, where we can begin to have our discussions with our friends on this and say, look, you're claiming essentially that suffering is an illusion. And I'm not just saying this from the Vedas and the Upanishads of the Hindus. This comes from Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra.
Exactly.
Eckhart Tolle says, to be enlightened, you need to let go of the past and forget about the future and live in the now. And therefore, you'll be free of suffering because it's all an illusion. And here's the real issue. When you look into the face of someone who's lost a child, and you've seen so much in your work, Jim, you know this, they don't think it's an illusion, that suffering. It's real. It's honest. It's real. It's raw. Pantheism tells you to escape it by saying it's an illusion. It's really an escapist philosophy. Contradistinction to Christianity, where Christianity tells you suffering is so real, suffering is so intense, suffering is such a sort of an important thing to deal with, that God himself comes down. We don't become God. God becomes one of us and suffers and dies on a cross to show you how actually real suffering is. I think, in one sense, Christianity gives dignity to the search for the escape from suffering, but tells you it's not an illusion, it's real. And it gives you the dignity of knowing that your suffering is actually real.
Yeah, no kidding. And there's just something about denying the power, the experience of suffering, or the reality, the true reality of suffering, that is in some way so disrespectful to the subject or the object of our suffering. So when you lose a child, to deny that we're suffering at the loss of the child in some ways belittles the value of the child itself. You know what I mean? It's like, this is not something that's worth acknowledging the power of your loss. It's almost to deny that there's any value in your loss. Anyway,
yeah, that's almost to deny the value of other people versus, you know, your own emotions. The thing about Eckhart Tolle says this, if I can just quote this really quick, in his book, The Power of Now. He says, enlightenment consciously chosen means to relinquish your attachment to past and future and to make the now the main focus of your life. You then don't need pain anymore. How much more time do you think you'll need before you are able to say, I will create no more pain, no more suffering? Wow. I look at that, I hear that quote, and he's saying, look, if you just forget about the past and stop worrying about the future and dwell in the now, you'll be free of suffering. And then I think to myself, could he look into the face of a parent who lost a child at Sandy Hook and say, don't dwell on the past with that child and stop worrying about the future you'll never have with that child. Just dwell in the now and you'll be free of the suffering you're creating. My question to him is this. Are you serious?
No kidding.
Can you be serious? That's insulting. With all due respect to Mr. Tolle and his 10 million selling book, that's insulting.
Yeah,
I find there to be no real root there for a worldview that could possibly tell me I should believe that if it so values little, you know, the loss that I experienced in the life of that child.
No, I agree. Let's go to the third group now, the third worldview examined here in Grand Central Question, answering the critical concerns of the major worldviews, and that is the worldview of Islam. And you've entitled it Islam or the Gospel. So what's the Grand Central Question in this worldview?
Well, this I knew right away. As soon as I was thinking about how to formulate and figure out what the central question was, I knew from my own life what it was. Everybody has heard the phrase, Allahu Akbar. We have all heard it, and unfortunately, when we hear it, something explodes or something bad happens. The reality, though, is that most Muslims say Allahu Akbar in very peaceful ways. They just say it in a devotional way. It literally means God is greater. So Allahu Akbar is a central idea to all of Islam. In fact, I rejected, growing up, I rejected every single Christian doctrine that was important. The Trinity, the deity of Christ, and the atonement. I rejected those ideas because I thought they insulted God's greatness. That was the very issue. So for the Muslim, he resists Christianity for a number of reasons, but the chief one is because he says, no, God is great. God is so great, he would never be a triune God, and he would never become incarnate, and he would never die at the hands of the sinners he himself created. How is this God great? So that's the central question for all of Islam. How do we worship a God who is truly great and try to understand our faith in that way?
Yeah, that's excellent observation, and I think that's something we can focus on then, because it really comes down to, would you agree, in some part, it just comes down to the definition, what we call greatness to begin with. But how would you answer specifically, and you've got four sections of this, four chapters really in part three here, where you kind of parse this out, but how would you respond to somebody who held your position for all those years that, like you just said, that God's greatness is really what's at jeopardy here, and how would you respond to somebody who says that the Islamic view of God's greatness is actually greater?
I would affirm the very fact that they want to worship a God who is great. You know, we have to sort of affirm the things that we both agree on, and that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is this. Let's take an example. The Trinity is an example. Muslims will say the Trinity doesn't make any sense, and it's a blasphemy because it says that God needs helpers, and he needs something, and therefore it can't be true. But when you look at the Trinity, and this is one of my favorite topics to talk about, actually, the Trinity, because when I finally understood it, I finally saw a God who was truly great. A Muslim states that God is great. A truly great God, the greatest possible being, in fact, would need nothing to be who he is. He would need nothing to be who he is. And Muslims claim that God is relational. There are 99 beautiful names for God in the Quran. Almost all of them are relational names. So in other words, God is intensely relational. Yet the Muslim claims that God doesn't need anything. But here's the problem. If God is the only uncreated being, and Muslims claim that he is, then he was unable to be relational toward anything else because nothing else existed except for him. Put another way, he needed something else to exist to be who he is.
Right.
But if he needs something else to exist, then he can't be great. That's where the Trinity comes in. And that's why I think the Trinity is a solution, not a problem. In the Trinity, there's one God who exists as three distinct persons and one being who lives in community. He always has relationship. He's always Father, Son, Holy Spirit, each one distinctly loving and communing with the other. So the Trinitarian God does not lack anything. He always has relationship. And a truly great God would not lack anything. But it goes one step further, Jim, and that's this. A Muslim thinks that God is loving. Now, it's conditional. It's highly conditional, the God of Islam. But he is, in fact, loving. The greatest love you can have, and everyone knows this from their own experiences, is unconditional love. That's what a parent's love is, and that's even to some degree what we can have even in marriage. But that love is sort of given selflessly. Well, in the Trinity, you have a God who does not need us to have relationship, but he creates us anyway. not so that he can have relationship, but so that we can have relationship, and that is a truly altruistic, self-giving God.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You've got a chapter called God's Triune Greatness and the Greatness Incarnate. Those two chapters that really kind of parse out in detail very eloquently what you've been talking about here. And so we're only down to a few minutes, before we get to the end of our show, Abdu. But I wanted just to tell people, first of all, this is a very quick read. I thought it was very, very fast to read, very accessible, and it kind of gives you a great overview of three of the, probably more likely than not, these are the three worldviews you're going to be dealing with in your conversations here in America with people who don't hold a Christian worldview. So you've got great kind of marching orders, a template here, by where you can kind of walk through these three worldviews. Now, Abdu, I know if you're like me, your calendar is probably like jammed, okay? But I wanted to give you a second before we finish our show today just to talk about where it is, what kinds of opportunities has this book provided for you going forward? Have you seen an opportunity to kind of share the gospel even more than before, having written this?
Oh, far more. We're finding ourselves now. I'm finding myself in foreign countries talking on these very issues. I was in Peru last year talking to senators and congresspeople about the grand central question. And I'll tell you, afterwards, I spoke with a high-ranking official who had tears in her eyes because her daughter had walked away from the faith because of the death of the loved one. And she was elated. Those tears were tears of joy because now she had an answer to the problem of suffering and the problem of evil. As but one example, we got all these opportunities. You know, one opportunity I would recommend to the listeners, if those who are even far away but near to Michigan, is we have this Remind Conference, sort of a take on Rethink. Alan Schliemann will be there. We wanted you to be there, Jim, but your schedule isn't that jammed. But Remind Conference, it's at remindconference.com. Alan will be there. I'll be there. Some RZIM speakers, Mike Lacona, others. We'd love to see youth and young adults there. So remindconference.com. But we've seen the gospel, the doorways open for the gospel because of this book in some incredible ways that I could only begin to share with you.
Okay, so now before I let you go, though, let's just tell people where they can Remind's a great. I'm glad you brought that up. You're absolutely right. I wanted to be there. I'm so sorry my schedule got jammed. And it's one of those
always
things.
Next year.
That's right. That's right. I'll be there. Just tell me now and I'll put it on my calendar. But tell people where they can actually go to find you online to kind of to dig into the resources you have available for them.
Oh, absolutely. We have a website. It's embracethetruth.org. That's our main website, and we have some free videos and some free materials available for folks, whether it's articles and videos and other things. Got a web store there as well, embracethetruth.org. They can also sort of request us to speak through that website. And also we have some materials on rzim.org. Through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. But the main place to go is embracethetruth.org.
And I have to tease that real quickly. I mean, I know you're more and more involved with RZIM, and so that just kind of divides your time a little bit, but it's even giving you more opportunities, I assume, to go around the world and share the gospel. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. We've been in Peru several times now, all across the U.S. and Canada. Just got back from Toronto, actually, where I was sharing and interacting with some Sikhs. Up there in the incredibly diverse area of Toronto, Hong Kong coming up soon, possibly an India trip, and more trips down south to South America to do more gospel sharing. And these are largely evangelistic open forums where we're having people come and ask their questions. Some of the biggest and most influential universities in these countries,
so awesome,
where we're seeing just tremendous fruit.
Well, Abdu, I know that I see your ministry growing. I see your outreach growing. I'm very proud of you. I'm glad to be associated with you on occasion. We get to hang out, and I'm just so grateful to have you as a brother. And we look forward to seeing what's going to happen with you. So everyone here who's listening to the show this day, I would encourage you to go get Grand Central Question. And thanks, Abdu, for even spending time with us on today's show.
It was such a pleasure and such an honor. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome. And that'll do it for us this week here at Stand to Reason. As Greg often says at the end of the show, it's your chance to go out now and give him heaven. And until next time, what you'll have here next week, Greg will be back. So I'll see you right here, and he'll see you right here at Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.